Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I know this agreement won't make every Republican happy. It certainly won't make every Democrat happy either. But both parties gave more ground than they wanted to. And neither side got as much as it had hoped.
In spite of our differences, I think we're dealing with reasonable, responsible people who want this crisis to end as quickly as possible.
First part of this agreement will cut about $1 trillion in spending over the next 10 years, cuts that both parties had agreed to early on in this process. The result would be the lowest level of annual domestic spending since Dwight Eisenhower was president.
So, don't worry, soldiers in Afghanistan who've been reported to be asking their superiors, seniors in Brooklyn, anyone else, you will apparently not get cut off this week from paychecks, Social Security checks, whatever, as the big three, who you just heard there, are now on the same side of the tentative debt ceiling agreement. President Obama, House Speaker John Boehner, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who we heard in those clips. It raises the $14.5 trillion borrowing authority of the federal government immediately by about a trillion, while promising that much or more in cuts, with a second stage to come by year's end. And this is where it gets actually interesting, more interesting than confusing and obscure, I promise, either through the recommendations of a bipartisan congressional committee or through automatic cuts to Medicare and defense spending and other things that would be triggered if Congress does nothing, like a guillotine hanging over their heads just for doing nothing. So is this good for America? Is it good for you? Will the House have enough votes to even pass it? With me now, our tentative debt ceiling deal all-stars, Raihan Salam. He is co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. And he writes The Agenda, the domestic policy blog at National Review. His headline this morning on that blog, Debt Ceiling Deal Less Than Meets the Eye. And he argues that contrary to most of what you may be hearing, the debt ceiling deal could be seen as more tax heavy than cuts heavy. Dave Weigel from Slate and MSNBC, who has posted language this morning to help progressives write your own angry denunciation of the debt ceiling agreement, and Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome back to WNYC, all of you. Hello.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I want to invite, as our first callers, anyone who considers yourself a Tea Party supporter, because from what I can tell from the media coverage, this is where the most uncertainty is this morning. Tea Party supporters, is this a debt ceiling deal that you can live with for the moment, or do you want your congressperson to vote no, vote hell no? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Don't worry, everybody else will get a shot. But for the moment, Tea Party supporters, you get the first crack at the phones. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. 9692, Tea Party supporters only for the next, say, 10 minutes or so. So if you call right up, you'll get right on. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you consider yourself a Tea Party supporter and are pro-con or ambivalent on this tentative debt ceiling deal. Or you can post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show or a politics website, itsafreecountry.org. All right, guests, first, can we fact check the president from that clip we just played? Raihan Salam, do you agree that this deal lowers – now, let's see. I thought I had the transcript in front of me, but I don't. How did he say it? Lowers domestic spending to the lowest levels as a percentage of something since Eisenhower? And what does that mean?
Well, I think that it all depends on how this plays out. I think that one thing that it's important to keep in mind is that this is an ongoing process. And so, for example, if the economy continues to be weak a year and a half from now, it's quite possible that many of these cuts will be delayed. And so, you know, it's very hard to say how this is all going to unfold.
Dave Weigel, can I turn to you on that same question? Did you hear that quote of the president comparing spending levels as in some way lower than any time since Eisenhower? And what do you take that to mean? How do you explain it? And then is it good, bad, or indifferent as far as you're concerned?
Well, Raihan's right that we've got some more debating to do before we see how deep the cuts actually go. There are cuts that are scheduled for this year. The big cuts, though, that will come at the end of this year or at the beginning of next year will either consist of automatic 50-50 cuts to discretionary and spending and defense spending, or they'll consist of something the commission puts together. So we have the potential of big cuts that make sense and do that. This plan, though, it's structured this way, just kind of like the Bush tax cuts were structured in order to get votes. This plan doesn't it front loads some, but it doesn't get to those massive potential cuts until later.
Karen Tumulty, same question. I want to fact check the president. And again, here's the actual wording that we played. The result would be the lowest level of domestic spending since Dwight Eisenhower was president. Where did he get that language?
I absolutely have no idea whether this is true or not. It's, you know, all of these things are projections from, you know, probably a Congressional Budget Office baseline. You know, this is kind of trying to take it and make it fit on a bumper sticker. But, I don't even know that statements like that are even meaningful, given the size of how much the economy has grown since then and, you know, the adjustments for how much cost of living have grown.
Mike in Jersey City, Tea Party supporter?
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for calling. What do you think of this?
I think it's time for the Tea Party to take steal a page from Nikolai Lenin's handbook. All right, it's time to take one step backward in order to take two steps forward. We will lose the public relation war, I think, if we push any harder. I mean, the fact is that this deal is loaded with a significant amount of crap, but it's also got some real cuts, and the basic concept that what we're going to do now is lower spending without talking about for some reason, the guys with the corporate jets got off this time, is a good thing. I think secondarily, for the Tea Party's agenda, I think Barack Obama not being reelected is of paramount importance. I'm not saying people should agree with that, but from the Tea Party's viewpoint, that's pretty important. And I think at this point, continuing to fight this particular battle is going to distract from that. And so, again, to sum it up, I think it's time to take one step backward in order to take two steps forward.
Interesting, Mike. Thank you very much. And Peter in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Tea Party supporter?
Huge Tea Party supporter, Brian. And I guess my question for your panel there is, with the $800 billion that the president has shoved into the last budget, which really I think is the crux of the problem, and the fact that Wall Street, Moody's are looking for a $4 trillion cut, is this just not smoke, mirrors, and window dressing? Are we really doing anything to address the fundamental issue that we've raised our budget by over $800 billion a year?
Well, considering that there's more spending cuts in here than debt ceiling increase, if the media is writing it up accurately, is that nothing in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, I think since we've, again, looked at the 08 budget to compare to, I know we are not working under an actual budget now. They haven't voted on a budget in over 2.5 years. But looking that they've increased the spending limit with Obamacare over $800 billion, is $100 billion a year or a trillion over 10 years? To me, no. It's a little drop in the bucket. It's just not enough. We should go back to, say, let's say 08 levels and really try to balance the budget.
So let's say you're in Huntington. Who's your congressman?
Israel.
He's a Democrat, so you're probably not in sync with him, but should the Republicans in Congress, in your opinion, vote no on this?
Unfortunately, I think for the betterment of the country, I would push them to vote no, but I don't think anybody right now, except for maybe the very junior Republicans, have the real spirit to stick together and do what's right for the country. I think right now it's a little bit of window dressing to make everybody feel good. But they haven't addressed the underlying issue, which is they need to cut, again, I'm going to say close to $600 to $800 billion mm-hmm. back out and look at the 08 spending levels and truly do what the president said, which is live within our means.
Thank you very much. Brian in Ridgewood in New Jersey, Tea Party supporter?
Good morning. Yes, absolutely.
And
everything that the Tea Party stands for. My comment is decision over the past 10 years to borrow 40% of the money they need to pay rent and groceries. And they want to continue doing it. But now they've made this great, great contribution to the national benefit that they are only going to borrow 30% of the money to pay the rent and the groceries.
Right. So do you want them to go back, vote no, play chicken with the deadline tomorrow, all the things that might happen to markets and interest rates and troops in Afghanistan getting paid, et cetera?
No. I want them to have done a better job up till now. Unfortunately, they've failed. They are, by the way, giving away the AAA here. As far as I can tell, S&P said, I need you to stop spending 40% borrowing, 40% of the money you need to pay groceries. And now they've said, oh, I'm only going to borrow 10%. How's that, S&P? Well, why is no one saying what S&P is going to talk about? If these guys were in the corporate world and they gave away a AAA so flagrantly, they'd be gone.
Brian, thank you very much. Okay, let's deal with different parts of what we just heard from those various Tea Party supporter callers. Dave Weigel from Slate, you've reported in depth on the Tea Party over a period of time. How representative do you think what we just heard was? And I'll tell you, as I'm reading all kinds of websites, including Tea Party websites, it's really vague to me as to whether there is a unified Tea Party position this morning, whether people are like our first caller from Jersey City who say, look, I'd really like a lot more than this, but we're going to give the election to Obama if we look so unreasonable as to not support this because we got something. Or are they more like, the other callers who are saying, look, this is just small potatoes. We need to go back and do it again. And how's that going to be reflected in the conservative bloc in the House?
Well, we heard one Leninist there who is willing to go along with this, and I think that's actually a little bit slimmer than the bulk of the Tea Party. I mean,
what do you mean, Leninist means what?
the Leninist who said take a step back and two steps forward. That is actually, I think, what a lot of rank and file in the Republican Party and in the Tea Party say. I mean, you're going to see a lot of sound and fury from Tea Party groups and from Republicans who have an edge in opposing the deal. I think, here's one example. On the last vote, the Boehner plan, which didn't really have a chance, but it's kind of the basis of this, more than 90% of Republicans in the House voted for that plan. But every single presidential candidate except for John Huntsman opposed it. Mitt Romney didn't really take a stance. Tim Pawlenty opposed it. Michelle Bachmann opposed it. Ron Paul opposed it. So the guys who want a advantage want to look more ideological. But most people in the party are going to go for this because it is the best possible deal they could have gotten. I would, as far as the rating goes, the way I read the language of the Moody's report today is that they are going to look at this deal and give us a AAA rating with a negative outlook, which is what we had already. I mean, these Sphinx-like pronouncements of the rating agencies have been more and more annoying as the process has gone on. In this case, I don't think there's that much of a threat here. They have to realize that this austerity package is one of the bigger things you could imagine in American politics, although I can see why they would be confused that we're not raising taxes as part of this. I know that was off the table politically, but some of your callers were talking about the numbers here, the amount of debt, the percentage. Look, this tax cut deal we signed into effect in December was worth about $500 billion of tax cuts. So I think that's the last thing to be worried about.
Adding
is that
to
we
the
had
debt.
To have that conversation at some point.
Raihan Salam, the whole point, I think, of having a deal that's supposed to cover the period until after the 2012 elections is to mollify the ratings agencies so that the AAA rating is not downgraded, because this looks like at least a medium-term deal, not that they'll come back in a few months and have to play brinksmanship with default again. Is that your take?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think that, the fear is that obviously a downgrade would actually radically increase the cost of debt service. And so that would actually dig us in an even deeper hole. And I think that, it does seem like a plausible plan, particularly with the automatic spending reductions. So I think that it should be reason enough to stave off a downgrade.
Raihan Salam from National Review Online and Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post. Are you counting heads? Is it possible to say whether this is going to pass the House?
I think at this point we have all learned that anybody who makes any predictions is foolish. But certainly with basically all of the leaders on board, we haven't really heard anything definitive from Nancy Pelosi. But all of the other leaders on board, it certainly looks positive.
Karen, who gets hurt by the spending cuts that they agreed to? We're hearing these top line numbers, $1 trillion here or there, and we're talking real money, you know. Is it people with subsidized student loans or Pell Grants or food stamps? Is it companies getting farm subsidies? Who gets hurt from the cuts that are definitely in this?
Well, it's pretty much everybody takes a haircut except for a few places. Programs that directly benefit the poor, like Medicaid, would not be cut. And Medicare, it looks as though the cuts would fall primarily on not on the beneficiaries, but on the providers. But, you know, getting beyond that, and Social Security is exempted. But presumably everybody else beyond that does, in fact, feel the cuts.
We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue with our Brian Lehrer Show tentative debt ceiling deal all-stars. And now we're going to start to get some of your opinions. And Dave Weigel, why you're helping progressives online write letters denouncing this deal. Raihan, why you think that even though most of the press is playing this as a spending cuts only debt ceiling deal, you think there are really tax hikes, maybe even more tax hikes than spending cuts in this. And Karen, some more of your takes. And now anyone can call 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.
We have to cut back on government spending, and by cutting back on spending, we may also have a negative impact on our economy. I'm afraid this dilemma is not going to serve our purposes very well. I'm not sure this is clear thinking.
If you spend more money, where does it come from? It's borrowed, because we're already in debt, and every new dime we spend is borrowed. There's only one way to move out of this, and that's to reduce spending.
Two takes from two senators on the tentative debt ceiling raising agreement. Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama there. Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate from Illinois. Before that, as we talk to our Brian Lehrer Show tentative debt ceiling agreement all-stars, Raihan Salam, co-author with Ross Douthat of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. And he writes The Agenda, the domestic policy blog at National Review Online. Dave Weigel from Slate and MSNBC, and Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Let's see. Dave, why are you helping progressives write letters of denunciation of this deal on Slate today?
That was a bit of a joke at the expense, or maybe in the spirit of Emanuel Cleaver, who runs the Congressional Black Caucus and has really fixated on the phrase sugar-coated Satan sandwich as a way to describe the deal. I was offering a bunch of other over-the-top adjectives and similes that Democrats can use, because a thing to watch today is Democratic anger that they have to agree to this thing. Again, we can argue about the cuts, but Democrats simply believe, because this is the economics they believe, that spending cuts at this point are going to be terrible for the economy. They don't want to have to run on them. They also don't want the country to have to live under them.
As we just heard from Dick Durbin in that clip, he's worried that at this moment, when things are going backwards again, it's not the time to cut off government spending, which would be destimulative.
Right, and if you look at other countries that are going through austerity plans, and I would caution, Britain's got an austerity plan that has tax increases as part of it, but their GDP has been just GDP growth has been abysmal. I mean, the Commerce Department says a reason our GDP growth was abysmal in the first couple quarters was that states were slashing left and right and they didn't have any stimulus money left. I mean, this is economics that Democrats agree with, but they can't get the country to agree with them on anymore.
Here, by the way, in case you missed it when we played it a half hour ago, is that Congressman Cleaver Satan sandwich clip.
Until we see the details, we're going to be extremely noncommitted, but on the surface, it looks like a Satan sandwich.
Now, Raihan Salam from National Review, I gather your position or NRO's position here is, hold on a minute, Dick Durbin. There really aren't much spending cuts that take effect in the current fiscal year, not for a couple of years, right?
Yeah, the spending cuts in this fiscal year would amount to about 0.15% of GDP. As one of our callers earlier on mentioned, the thing is that we have actually ramped up spending considerably. We've ramped it up in part because of the automatic stabilizers, increased transfer payments to people who are in economic distress, et cetera. So we're actually lowering it from what is already an unusually high baseline. And so I think that to those who are worried about it being destimulative, the truth is that these cuts are really strongly backloaded. They're so backloaded that they give Congress an opportunity to say, you know, come a year, 2 years hence, hey, wait a second, we're going too far. We can't actually do this just yet. But in this current year, the cuts are very, very modest. It's about $22 billion.
And Raihan, your colleague Josh Barrow on National Review Online's The Agenda, right below your picture, I'll point that out, which is why I thought it was yours, has a piece that I gather you agree with that says, wait, media, you're saying this is a spending cuts only debt ceiling agreement, but really there may be more tax cuts in here than even spending cuts over time. Why is that?
Well, it's because this agreement happens in a larger context of legislative changes. And one of the really big consequential legislative changes that's likely to come down the pike in 2012 is the expiration of tax cuts, which could raise as much as $2.8 trillion. Now, that's a situation which right now a lot of people said Republicans can hold the debt limit hostage, and that gives them a lot of leverage in terms of demanding these spending cuts, these notional spending cuts planned over the horizon of a decade. Whereas you're going to have a situation next year when the president can say, look, Democrats are happy to go to Clinton-era taxes, and you're not. So you have to come to the negotiating table, because if you do not play ball with me, taxes are going to automatically increase by, again, $2.8 trillion, which is more than the planned spending cuts in this proposal. So that's why I think that it's a much more balanced picture when you look not just discreetly at this one negotiation, but rather the larger landscape and how it's going to change over the next couple of years.
Karen Tumulty, do you think Raihan has something there despite the predominance of the cuts-only reporting today? You reported recently, I think, that anti-tax activist and anti-tax power broker Grover Norquist said he would not consider expiration of the Bush tax cuts a tax hike because it's just an expiration, and therefore he would not punish Republicans who go along. Is that relevant to this?
You know, I think that Grover Norquist was just making sort of a kind of semantic exercise on whether that is technically a violation of the pledge that he's gotten all these members to sign. You know, I think this is a theoretical argument, but every indication that we've had from actual experience is that and the most recent being last December, where they were also looking at the potential expiration of the Bush tax cuts, and the Democrats pretty much caved on that. It's just hard for me in this environment to see the Democrats and this president in particular going to the mat to raise taxes.
But they do have the lever, and that's the important thing.
Well, no, I think the political climate is more important than the lever. And again, it's hard for me to see them in this political climate taking that argument too far.
It's also a risk to say that, hey, we want to cut Medicare in this political climate. So I think that, you know, really both sides are making a political gamble. And so, you know, but the premise is, what are the automatic levers that are going on here? And does that give the president an opportunity, if he has more political leverage come next year, to make that happen?
Dave Weigel, you want to get in here?
Well, that's the worry that has some Republicans standing back from this. Look, the triggers that are part of this are blunt. They're just 50% discretionary spending cuts, 50% defense spending cuts, which is actually, if you're a Republican and you're faced with the choice of those cuts or with some package that includes tax increases, if you're listening to Grover Norquist, don't have them listen to Grover Norquist, you're not going to take the tax increases. I mean, even if we're in a situation, which I can't imagine right now, but a situation where the economy is growing again, and most economists would tell you the tax increases would make some sense, that's just not what they believe in. They feel like they've got deals to extend these things, and they feel like they've won the argument on that. So we're looking at a situation at the end of this year, really around Thanksgiving and around Christmas, where there's going to be probably something that looks like Bull Simpson, something that stings both sides. And I think the only hope that Democrats or Republicans have for that part of the commission is that if the tax component is something that just doesn't raise rates but flattens the code. I mean, we were starting to have that debate 2 weeks ago about getting rid of some tax breaks while lowering overall rates. That might be possible as part of this committee. I mean, we might, but I'm
thought
not
I heard,
given the dogmas.
I thought I heard Karen Tumulty, Democrats and Republicans all over the Sunday talk shows yesterday, saying that seems to be the bipartisan consensus, that they're going to enact broad tax reform as part of this phase two later in the year, which is a reduction of top rates, even below the Bush tax cuts, but eliminating lots of loopholes and deductions. Are we headed for that? Is that your sense?
I have a lot of trouble imagining that kind of conversation can really happen in Washington right before presidential primary season starts. That is one of those things that I guess the most recent time we've seen Congress and the president being able to sort of hold hands and jump over a cliff on restructuring the tax code was, you have to go all the way back to 1986. And again, this just does not strike me as the kind of ambitious reform that you can have right before you're about to have what is going to be a very big ideological argument in the presidential election.
Talking about the tentative debt ceiling agreement with Karen Tumulty from The Washington Post, Raihan Salam from National Review Online, and Dave Weigel from Slate. And Joe in Blairstown, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I kind of feel like as a Democrat that the Democrats have really abandoned the middle class, even with this latest deal. Without tax increases on the very wealthy in this country, let alone getting rid of the loopholes, as the Republican Party abandoned the middle class a long time ago, and at this point, the president and the Democratic Party looks like they've done the same thing, and it's really exasperating for all of us who are struggling at the middle level here. And that's just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Dave Weigel, could the Democrats have done better, in your opinion?
I think the president could have done a lot more to make an argument that is, at this point, counterintuitive. Again, there's just a real disconnect between what economists tell you of how this stuff works and what voters think. The president went for an explanation of the economy that sounds commonsensical, which is that you live within your budget, so should the government. And that drives Keynesians and most Democrats, that drives them haywire, because that's not quite the same thing. I mean, families don't declare no-fly zones over Libya. Families don't operate the way we do.
Well,
the president never
more
explained the long-term effects of spending or things like that. And so the argument was lost over the course of a few years, not just recently.
Did he not? I mean, he was out on television and not to mention on Twitter last week, and over the course of this whole summer, saying, look, I've got the balanced approach, the compromise approach. I'm offering three-quarter spending cuts for one-quarter more revenue. The Democrats are the reasonable party. The Republicans are taking the all-or-nothing approach. I mean, he said that till he was blue in the face. What more could he have done?
He still, while saying that, didn't make this big existential argument that can answer the existential Republican argument, which is we always should cut taxes. Tax cuts always stimulate growth. Growth always leads to more revenue. And it is tough to win this argument. Look, and economists wouldn't tell you that you should be raising taxes in a recession. That's totally true. But they would also tell you that you have some room to argue and to borrow and to spend as long as the economy is slack. Again, if you just look at the numbers through all these deals and all these processes, the stimulus bill was about 40% tax increases. The tax cut deal was about $500 billion of tax increases. You're looking
tax cuts, right?
decreases. You're looking at around close to $1 trillion of keeping tax rates at a low level and costing the government some revenue, or cutting taxes. And these didn't work very well. But the discussion in Washington and basically everywhere else still rests on this concept that the crazy spenders in Washington spent lots of money and didn't work. Well, they spent some money, didn't work as well as we wanted it to. But just this argument has been so undersold in a way that really frustrates Democrats. The Democrats are here, and a lot of Democrats who retired. Some of them say they retired because they couldn't deal with operating in an environment where the things they believe in, that they think make sense, that they think are proven out and borne out by facts, are just not part of the discussion. But everyone agreeing to a pledge to never raise taxes, even to the extent that it excludes a deal that would lower tax rates, maybe. Those guys are our part of the discussion. The rest of the Democrats aren't. And again, that's what you have to win over years. You can't just win in a few press conferences and speeches.
Karen Tumulty, how much second guessing is there among maybe factions on the White House staff about how this was handled, and that they wound up with a deal that's at least being portrayed as cuts only, no revenue?
They are. The White House has been speaking with so many voices throughout this, whether it was, Valerie Jarrett trying to portray the president as losing sleep over this, and Jay Carney saying, no, he's cool as a cucumber. basically, a lot of this for him is positioning himself for 2012, trying to position himself as the last reasonable person in Washington. And I agree with Dave. The problem there is that it made it harder for him to sell what he had already done, which is to convince people that, in fact, the stimulus package and the kind of spending that he did very early in his presidency had, yes, times are bad, but mm-hmm. they would have been worse if we hadn't done this.
Plus, is he consciously positioning himself as in line with the Republicans, Rehan Salam, do you think, to say, look, I'm the president who believes mostly in spending cuts?
Yeah, I think that is definitely part of it. And I think that when you talk to a lot of folks off the record in the White House now, I think that there's a sense that his big mistake was not in embracing Bull Simpson earlier on. Because when you look at the Bull Simpson proposal,
the big debt reduction proposal
that had a bipartisan imprimatur. And I think that when you look at that idea, there were big revenue increases. There was also a lot of idea for short-term stimulus in there as well. And it would have set the baseline in a different place initially. Just one thing I want to say about this middle class idea and the parties and how they're relating to the middle class is that when you a lot of us on the right believe that there is some government spending that actually makes the cost of living more expensive than it needs to be. And that's why a lot of us back Medicare reform, because really all of this domestic discretionary stuff, it's all secondary. Medicare is really the big issue, and it's something that actually makes life more expensive rather than less so for a lot of folks.
Let's hear what more of our callers think. Let's go through a bunch of people with some pretty quick comments, and then we'll get everybody's reaction, and then we'll be out of time. Ellen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just said to your screener that if the providers are going to, the Medicare providers are going to suffer from this, then of course the providees will suffer too. So what's the difference?
Right. So if the cuts under the trigger plan for later in the year would only be to reimbursements for Medicare providers, you're saying they're going to pass those along in reduced services. And that's what they say, in fact, would happen. John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Yes, hi, Mr. Lehrer. My point is I'm a strong Tea Party supporter, but I think they should go for this deal. And I'm a Tea Party supporter because of their talking points, basically. I don't like when the establishment class comes out saying, we cannot default, we cannot default. I think that plays in the Democrats' hand, that plays in Obama's hand. He sees that the Republicans will, for all the money, avoid default. He can go with them. So I like the language like Jim DeMint. We have to go further than August 2. So when he sees that Republicans holding strong, then he might cave a lot more. And I think that's the point here. When Republicans and Tea Parties came out against Boehner's bill, so Obama saw that he doesn't have support from the he needs to go far right to win the House. So that's the reason why I think that Republicans have won so much, and I think by now they should support this bill.
Thank you very much. Julia in Kingston, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julia.
Yes, hi. Your earlier Tea Party callers made the point that is so consistently made of 40% of expenditures come from borrowing, and you did what usually happens. You did not raise the slight quick comment that, well, if you raised revenues, that wouldn't be the case. And that's part of what your earlier guest just now, that the national debate has gone so much away from what many people feel is economic sense. Well, yeah, because they had these huge tax cuts. Yes, they're borrowing a lot to do what governments have to do. If they would raise the rates, they wouldn't have to. Or if they would cut some loopholes, though I don't buy, Lauren, the top rates myself.
Thank you. You don't buy lowering the top rates, right?
No, I don't. No. I mean, if they wanted to cut some loopholes, fine, but don't lower those top rates.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And Gary in Queens, you're on WNYC. Tea Party supporter?
I would like to ask the gentleman from National Review Online if he could rebut a true Tea Partier who never gets a chance to get on a show like this, Andrew C. McCarthy, who's been writing against, who's been essentially saying that you and Charles Krauthammer and Thomas Sowell are all full of crap. My words.
On what point? Just be really specific.
That the Boehner plan is a drop in a bucket. That this is not real cuts. This is just a slowing of the increase.
Thank you very much. Well, we certainly hear from our callers that we have a polarized public, at least among people who are calling in to this show today. So let's get a quick thought on where we go from here, from each of you. 30 seconds each to wrap up. Raihan Salam from National Review.
Conservatives have been winning political victories for, you know, better part of 30 years, yet government continues to grow in size. Government doesn't get radically more efficient. And I think that there's a lot of frustration that's built up over time in the sense that we need to turn the page, try something new, try to be more confrontational if necessary to get that change. And what worries me is this the way to achieve that change? Or have we actually endangered our position and made that change more difficult? That's what we don't know. That's what we're going to find out.
Dave Weigel from Slate.
Well, I think the point he just made is key. This is why, look, everyone who's in Republican politics has to couch themselves in this position of not liking the deal. Well, it hasn't been good enough. But secretly, they're giddy to hear a Democratic president brag that brag or try to portray these cuts as taking us back to the time of Dwight Eisenhower. Again, that's not ideal, but that's not something that was possible. It was not possible when Ronald Reagan was president. George Bush held no interest in it, which is a reason that the Republicans started to rebel against him. No, this is any time the discussion is about spending cuts. I have to interrupt my own sentence. That's rarely the case. The rule has been that you cut taxes and increase spending, or that you increase taxes and slow the rate of growth in spending. Even if this isn't ideal, this is just an enormous paradigm shift in the way that Washington thinks about this, and voters think about this. And it's basically a result of the stimulus package. It didn't. Okay. People feel like it didn't succeed, so they believe in doing the opposite, which gives conservatives leverage that they've never had before.
Karen Tumulty, the last word, 30 seconds.
Well, I think ultimately the answer to this entire problem is going to be economic growth, and certainly that is why we were able to balance the budgets in the 1990s. And there's a real question as to, you know, which side of this argument has the better argument on that side.
We're not seeing a lot of economic growth anytime soon, however, right, to generate more revenues that way.
But in the long run, that and getting our arms around some of the cost drivers and entitlements are going to be what solve this problem. And neither of those two things, I think, is really addressed in this deal.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Raihan Salam writes the domestic policy blog, The Agenda, for National Review Online. Dave Weigel writes for Slate. Thank you all very much for coming on with us.
Thanks
Thank
for having
you.
Us.
Thank
the
you.
Conversation continues. We'll have more on the debt ceiling tomorrow. We are expecting members of Congress from both sides to join us tomorrow morning when the House actually has to vote, and the outcome of that vote remains in doubt. But coming up next, the New York State Comptroller, Tom DiNapoli, on his audit of, and did you suffer through these yourself yesterday, the MTA's weekend construction work. Stay with us.